next met with Dr. Smith about mantle cell and diffuse large B-cell, and to begin, one question concerned a patient presented by the tumor board in Naples, Florida, a 62-year-old man with extensive mantle cell, and the questioner wanted to know about the relevance of the new European data that was just being presented at ASH.
I thought what was most interesting was probably the European Mantle Cell Network study where they did R-CHOP alternating with R-DHAP followed by stem cell transplant, and it shows that that R-DHAP addition does benefit in terms of responses and molecular responses. And of course, it's not a big surprise that adding something is better than nothing. But, you know, there's this whole question out there in the Nordic study and in Hyper-CVAD, there's a high-dose Ara-C arm, and this was, you know, it's not directly a high-dose Ara-C, but it does suggest that rituximab high-dose Ara-C does add something when followed by transplant.
Is it enough to change the way you approach patients?
I think, you know, there's still some young patients I'm doing Hyper-CVAD, you know, the full Hyper-CVAD, but in that mid-range where I think R-CHOP transplant is probably where I'm going, I think it would. I would probably give them the R-CHOP alternating with R-DHAP and then proceed with the high-dose chemo stem cell transplant at that point.
Right, because actually, if I think back to that meeting, the patient there was a 62-year-old man who, on biopsy, had, quote, highly proliferative mantle cell with IGVHCCND1 gene rearrangement suggestive of aggressive disease. As a result of these data, would you approach a patient like that differently?
Yeah, so he's on the borderline. I mean, if you thought he was in good shape and you could do a full Hyper-CVAD methotrexate cytarabine, you might still do that. If you were thinking, no, that's too intensive, I'm going to do R-CHOP autotransplant, this is exactly the patient who you would say, yes, I'm going to give R-CHOP alternating with R-DHAP and then stem cell transplant. So it might really alter your approach.
Another question, do you use BR upfront in patients with mantle cell in whom transplant's being planned?
One of the concerns about the bendamustine is how good stem cell collection will be, and that's a concern. So the answer, the simple answer to that is no, I haven't. There is a study in development that's going to be a U.S. intergroup study, which will have several cycles of R-Hyper-CVAD or several cycles of R-bendamustine followed by autotransplant, and we'll ask exactly that question. But right now, there's really not a lot of data, systematic, you know, published data. It's only anecdotal.
So is it more a case of we don't have the data, or is there anything that's come out that would make you think there's going to be a problem with stem cell collection?
No, I think we don't have the data. In Rummel's bendamustine rituximab R-CHOP study, a small number of patients they reported who did try to get cells collected, they were successful. So there's no warning indication. It's just a theoretic, you know it's myelosuppressive, so you wonder how stem cell toxic it might be.
Just, you know, kind of the same issue, but in terms of indolent lymphoma, is that then a consideration when you consider the controversial question of BR versus R-CHOP? You know, do you think that you're going to be thinking about transplant?
So, yeah, that is some of the reservation, and everyone just switching wholeheartedly to RB is the concern about that. Although I must say that the number of patients with low-grade lymphoma or indolent lymphoma who get transplanted is fairly low. I mean, it has to be a young, healthy patient with rapidly progressive disease after one or two short remissions. So it's not a huge indication. The concern is more, are you compromising the ability to get additional treatments in, whether it's transplant or other myelosuppressive therapies?
So the second question kind of relates to what you were talking about before. Can the panel comment on the importance of Ara-C in the treatment of mantle cell lymphoma?
Right, and that is a key question because when you look at the Hyper-CVAD alternating with methotrexate cytarabine or the Nordic data, there are high-dose Ara-C components. And now with the German data, it really does look like a high-dose Ara-C-based portion is important. Now, how much of that is high-dose Ara-C, how high dose, how many cycles, where does it fall, are all interesting questions. But it does seem to play an important role in this disease.
What are your thoughts about a non-Ara-C regimen that's out there, the so-called modified R-Hyper-CVAD that Brad Call reported?
His results are pretty good, but again, it's all phase two, and that's the problem with mantle cell. Most of the data out there are phase two, and depending on age, MIPI score, all of these other prognostic factors, things can be quite different, and so it's hard to compare. It would be an interesting study, you know, Hyper-CVAD with the methotrexate Ara-C versus not. I don't think anyone's necessarily going to do that study, but the Jarman study is as close to asking the IRC question directly as we have.
Another question, is there a role for R maintenance for MCL, patients in first remission?
So the textbook answer to that so far is that rituximab has been pretty modest, and there really was not a lot of rituximab maintenance data. There was a German study with RFCM with rituximab maintenance that showed a percentage of people did quite well. In Brad Call's modified hypercVAD Part A that you mentioned, there was 2 years of rituximab maintenance, and that may have contributed to his good results. Again, the Europeans have a study out there, R-CHOP versus R-fludarabine cyclophosphamide, and then rituximab maintenance. And we're expecting to hear those results sometime either at ASCO or the Lugano meeting in the summer. The word on the street suggests that that will be a positive study and probably put rituximab maintenance sort of more in the tried and true when tested realm. But right now, you'd have to say a lot of us do it, but there's not a lot of data.
Are the U.S. cooperative groups addressing this question?
Well, so I'm actually writing the U.S. intergroup study for the older than 60, and we had to readjust that too. That was a lenalidomide versus nothing, and now it's rituximab lenalidomide versus rituximab. There's an induction question, but the maintenance question, everybody's going to get rituximab maintenance and then with or without lenalidomide. So it's going to change the game, and suddenly everyone was scrambling to change their in development trials based on what we hear.
That's cool. Really cool. Yep. You guys are getting to be like the hormonalists in breast cancer now, you know?
Well, you know, it's a problem because really the results are starting to look so good. It used to be, oh, PFS was 18 months and, you know, your trial was done in 2 years. But now with the newer drugs and the maintenance, we're starting to look like indolent lymphoma. Our trials are going to go 5 years or longer before we get answers.
Yeah, I mean, same thing's going on with myeloma too, with
exactly.
The idea of maintenance and all. Okay, yep. So another question, do you get EGD and colonoscopy in all mantle cell patients?
I usually would say no to that. Colonoscopy's gone back and forth. The problem is that even if it looks normal, if you biopsy it, they're almost all positive, and it doesn't really change what you do. So in the rare instance where it might change what I do, or certainly if there's any symptoms, I would do the appropriate test. But just as part of routine staging, I generally don't.
Okay, so another one relevant to what you're talking about, lenalidomide in maintenance in a non-transplant setting for MCL.
So there's really no data for lenalidomide maintenance in mantle cell. Obviously, it's there in myeloma. It's an active agent, so it makes sense, and we will be testing it. But there's no data out there at this point, and I wouldn't do it off trial.
Is there a role of RCVP in mantle cell lymphoma as frontline therapy?
Absolutely. I think there's a very old randomized trial of R-CHOP versus RCVP in what was then called centricytic lymphomas. Most of those would be mantle cells. Very small trial, about 30 patients per arm, and there was no clear benefit. Now, it may just have been underpowered, but the benefit of anthracycline in mantle cell, similar to indolent and follicular lymphoma, has never been convincingly demonstrated. Now, we tend to do it, but I certainly have older patients where I use RCVP instead of R-CHOP frontline.
Kind of makes me think about, is BR the new RCVP in that regard?
Well, right. So if you think that BR is better than R-CHOP, so in my elderly mantle cell patients where a while back I might have given RCVP, most of those I'm going to give BR. And in fact, the induction question in the new elderly intergroup trial being written is bendamustine rituximab with or without bortezomib. So the trial under design is asking the induction, does bortezomib add to BR, and in maintenance, does lenalidomide add to rituximab?
Right, and that actually relates to the last question. Before I get to that, maybe that's what this person meant by, is there a role for RCVP up front now? Maybe the end of that sentence was that BR is available.
Right, and I think to that question, mostly the data for RCVP is not that solid. The data for R-bendamustine is. So I think in most cases, so it's not wrong to give RCVP, but certainly R-bendamustine probably will replace RCVP.
So last question here. Are there situations where you use bortezomib up front, either alone or combined with other agents?
I suppose I could envision such a case if they really couldn't tolerate anything else. But it really is approved in the relapse setting, and it really doesn't have a lot of upfront data by itself. We've added it to Brad Call's modified hypoCVAD. That's called VCR-CVAD. But you have to be a little careful when you add it to other agents. We don't have a lot of combination data. There's potential neurotoxicity. But again, I think a bortezomib, steroid, rituximab regimen in the right patient wouldn't be a crazy idea.
And again, thinking about myeloma, there's a lot of excitement there about carfilzomib and the further generation proteasome inhibitor. Has that been looked at in mantle cell?
Not yet, but it would be great to look at these newer IMIDs and proteasome inhibitors to replace the lenalidomide and the bortezomib, or at least possibly be less toxic and as or more effective. So we're clearly going to be looking at those studies, but they're trailing a little bit behind the myeloma data.
So yeah, I see you know, just getting started on some of these lenalidomide maintenance things. What about, you know, again, pomalidomide? There's a lot of interest in myeloma and same thing.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's coming and we'd love to do that, but you sort of have to go with the relapse setting first and then move it maybe up front or in maintenance. So they're going to always trail a little bit behind the lenalidomide and bortezomib trials.
Any idea right now in terms of what fraction of mantle cell patients are accessing tertiary centers with research trials or have that access available to them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know of any data. It would be interesting to do sort of the Friedberg LymphoCare study on mantle cell and see what people are doing and where they're getting their treatment. The hope is that these new intergroup studies will provide current levels of care, at least in the upfront setting, in the community.
All right, a few questions here about diffuse large B-cell. What's your opinion regarding CNS prophylaxis in diffuse large B-cell, intrathecal versus high-dose methotrexate?
So the CNS prophylaxis question is generated a lot of discussion, and unfortunately we don't have a lot of data. There was a sense coming out of ASH that in the rituximab chemo era that maybe the incidence of this has gone down somewhat, so that's encouraging. There's a concern that CNS relapses often are earlier and parenchymal than we often appreciate, and so it makes sense that intrathecal is not going to be as effective, and there's a sense that incorporating high-dose methotrexate to get across the blood-brain barrier into the brain and prophylax that early would be beneficial, but there's really not a lot of data to support that. And with the sense that the incidence may be going down, I think the enthusiasm for such a trial is waning, but I still think it would be an important trial to do. But absent data, most of us still use intrathecal in the appropriate setting, and haven't really gone over to systemic methotrexate since clearly that's toxic and we don't have proof that it's a benefit.
Here's an interesting one. What's the normal dose for bendamustine in diffuse large B cell? And I put a second part of that question is, do you use it?
And so I would say that's the first question.
Yeah, right.
Really not a lot of data for bendamustine in large cell lymphoma. There is some, and there's no reason to think it wouldn't work, but there's not a lot of data. So I think when you use bendamustine and presumably relapse large cell, you're sort of off the beaten track and you don't know what to do. But I think most of us feel comfortable primarily with 90 milligrams per meter squared days 1 and 2. The trial that got it licensed in this country was 120 per meter squared every 3 weeks. And you can do that, but it's very toxic, a lot of treatment delays and things like that. So most of us use 90 in the presence of rituximab. And in large cell, I might try to get in every 3 weeks. In low grade, I just try to do every 4 weeks.
Actually, if you remember at the meeting, we had this case that we had a little debate between the faculty, Dr. Maloney, and the treating docs about this case where the patient had a complete response to BR and the local doc was going with the diagnosis of follicular lymphoma. And Dave stood up there and said, you know, I think this patient has diffuse large B cell. And then we went to Matthias Rommel and said, well, what's the deal? And he goes, oh, yeah, we use it all the time, but I guess there's not much data out there.
No, I mean, so they've used it, and, you know, it's been around in Germany for so long that, of course, they've used it, but there's not a lot of data. I have had patients who haven't responded to anything else. We're trying to get them to transplant, or I have used it, and other people have used it. So it does happen, but it's not sort of my first choice because we just don't have a lot of data. But, you know, if they failed several regimens and I'm looking for something that might work, it's not unreasonable to try it.
Yeah, you hear about bendamustine, and lenalidomide's another one in weird places. I think they're actually looking at some of these agents in solid tumors. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, bendamustine clearly, you know, it's an alkylator type
right,
regimen.
Right, yeah, so, right.
So it makes sense, and I know it's being studied in breast cancer and some of the other ones. And the lenalidomide, you know, again, we don't know how the heck this stuff works.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things where you try it and everything. I think they were using it in... Yeah, I did see something recently. It was a relatively uncommon solid tumor or something. But yeah, it's definitely, you know, these drugs need to be tested because we don't really understand how they work.
Yeah. Yeah, I know this thing we were talking about, mechanisms of resistance to the IMiDs. And I'm like, well, what's the mechanism that they actually work?
Well, I think that's why people are hoping if we find out how they're resistant, then we'll at least know that's one of the ways they work.
Right. All right, diffuse large B-cell again. Can you make a comment concerning the potential role of liposomal doxorubicin?
So I think of liposomal doxorubicin as a way of getting sort of an infusional anthracycline instead of a bolus. And I give credit to MD Anderson where for years they gave 48-hour infusion of anthracycline rather than bolus. And I know that they are doing some work with liposomal doxorubicin. We haven't reported it, but treated a number of cases. And I tend to use it where patients with diffuse large B-cell have borderline cardiac function. Not so bad that I think, oh, I can't even give them any anthracycline, but I'm looking for something to minimize the cardiac risk. So the very elderly or borderline ejection fraction, I'll substitute the liposomal form for the doxorubicin. And, you know, I think it should be relatively equivalent in efficacy and certainly... You know, yes, there's less alopecia, but the main thing is it's probably less cardiotoxic.
What about mitoxantrone?
Yeah, mitoxantrone was, you know, years ago was sort of the trying to get into that space, and the trials actually, there were some problems with the data, and it never really panned out. I think epirubicin is one that might be less cardiotoxic that's not used as much in the U.S. as in Europe. So I think liposomal doxorubicin is probably the one that most of us feel most comfortable with in trying to minimize cardiotoxicity.
Actually, another sort of cardiac-related question related to a patient that we actually presented who has a decreased ejection fraction to R-CHOP, which is why not switch to a non-anthracycline regimen? Do you do that, and which one?
Yeah, so... This issue of how do you deal with either the very elderly or the cardiac compromised diffuse large B-cell patient comes up all the time. It's one of the most common emails and questions I get. And what I usually respond is if it's kind of borderline, I'll often go with a liposomal doxorubicin. If it's clearly a case of, no, I'm not comfortable giving him any anthracycline, I felt better. ASH of 2009, there were two studies which replace the anthracycline with etoposide. And those data looked against historical controls pretty reasonable, not quite as good as anthracycline, but pretty good. So CEOP is one that I've used. And that's probably the favorite if I don't think that an anthracycline is possible. There was an ASH abstract on mini-CHOP, and they dropped the anthracycline dose. They also dropped the cyclophosphamide and the vincristine and everything. I'm not sure you need to do that. Back in the day, there was an old SWOG study, I believe, where they dropped the doxorubicin by half and then increased it if tolerated, and those results were not so good, but that was in the pre-rituximab era, so maybe the rituximab overcomes that. So to summarize, I would say liposomal doxorubicin in the borderline patient and CEOP in the absolutely can't get anthracycline patient.
Okay, so another question here about diffuse large B-cell. I have a 68-year-old woman with diffuse large B-cell with 20% FL in the same node confined to the right neck. Do I approach as a stage 1 aggressive with R-CHOP times 3 followed by RT?
So the node is diffuse large cell with some follicular.
Right.
I guess the question is, so if that's the only node, then clearly yes, because you want to treat them more aggressive and there isn't anything to do for stage 1 follicular. You're adding the radiation anyway. So you'd be doing the accepted treatment for stage 1 follicular and you'd be over-treating the follicular by treating for the diffuse large B cell. The interesting question is someone has follicular, you know, they show up like this and then you find follicular in the marrow or, you know, some other nodes which are considered follicular. And then do you have to treat? And the answer is the same thing. I still treat. If I'm convinced that the transformed lymphoma is localized, I will treat that as localized large cell and tell the patient that the follicular may well recur in the future, but we'll worry about that at the time.
So here's my part B that this person didn't write in, but I'll throw in, which is, would you use R maintenance?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. For diffuse large B-cell, the answer is no. Stage 1 follicular, I probably wouldn't because they could do well for, very long time. But in the patient who has underlying follicular and then transforms, I do sometimes add rituximab maintenance, treating it as I would a follicular and saying, well, it's not going to hurt the large cell.
So how about, again, thinking about both large cell and mantle cell, anything at ASH encouraging, biologically or translationally? I mean, it really was different.
Yeah. Well, I think the most exciting drugs out there, and actually most of the data at ASH was in CLL, but they work in all B cells, are these drugs which work in the B cell receptor signaling pathway.
So I knew you were going to say that. Cal-101, right?
Well, Cal-101 and then the BTK, which
right,
is the
BTK. What
BTK
is that?
Inhibitor. It's
remind me what that stands for, the BTK?
Bruton's tyrosine kinase.
Okay.
Because Bruton's tyrosine kinase was isolated relative to this Bruton's agammaglobulinemia, which is a congenital disease where they are missing this and they don't develop B cells and make no gamma globulin, no antibodies. So it makes sense that inhibiting it would knock down B cells. So that was actually at ASCO last year, but it was updated at ASH. And then you have the Cal-101, PI3 kinase, and you also have, not at this ASH, but from about a year and a half ago, the SYK inhibitor, the SYK inhibitor. So all of these are in the same B cell receptor signaling pathways.
Can you take a shot at explaining that? I mean, they're small molecules, correct?
Right.
TKIs?
They're all tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Yep.
So obviously they're inside the cell, but what has this got to do with the B cell function?
So if you think about a B cell sits out there in the lymph node and it's resting. And it comes into the germinal center and it starts to divide. And when it's resting, it stays alive because it has BCL2 on, and BCL2 prevents cell death. When it goes into the lymph node, you want to select for B cells that are going to be driven. If you're fighting a strep infection, you want B cells that bind to strep antigens. So the B cell goes into the germinal center and starts to divide. It turns BCL2 off. And now it's going to die unless it gets another survival signal. That survival signal actually goes through the B cell receptor. So the B cell receptor signaling is required in some cases to keep the B cell alive. And so if you can knock down the B cell receptor signaling, the cell will no longer get that survival signal and it'll die. The B cell receptor is basically antibody on the surface. And so downstream from that, just like from the EGF receptor, you get these little kinases and you can inhibit them. The B cell antibody binds to antigen. There's a signal transduced that goes all the way down to the nucleus. And if you can interrupt that signal at various places with tyrosine kinase inhibitors, you can turn off the B cell receptor signaling, which is required for cell survival. And these just hit it in different parts. And if you keep following further down the pathway, you get into the mTOR inhibitors and things like that. So all of these then work along the same path. And eventually, obviously, you could combine them and, there are other issues. And you could, cells that don't die because of this might still be alive because of BCL2. And then you could throw in BCL2 inhibitors. So it opens up a way for picking apart the cell signaling pathways of proliferation and apoptosis and combining things in a way that you can ultimately kill any cell you want.
Well, that was surprisingly understandable. How about if you want to throw into that model you just created in our heads where rituximab fits in?
So rituximab could fit in just because it's another signal for cell death, but actually rituximab does affect BCL2 levels and does affect calcium influx, so it indirectly impacts on many of these pathways. I don't think we really know if it directly affects B-cell receptor signaling. I don't know of any data in that area.
So in terms of these new TKIs, have you actually had a patient who you could say had a clinical benefit from one of these agents?
Yes. I mean, I think the Cal-101 looks very impressive.
With what kind of tumor did the patient have?
CLL.
CLL.
Yeah, so most of that data so far is in CLL, but that's just where it's been tested, but I think it works in a variety of B-cell lymphomas.
So now, again, you've seen patients who just got monotherapy with this agent and had a response?
Monotherapy, yes.
This is Cal-101?
Yep.
Yeah, starting to hear that. So can you see its way clear to actually being approved in the future, or is it way far away from that? Or
I think it's probably the closest, you know, but again, you know, it's not 6 months from now, but I think it's impressive enough and it's going to be fairly easy to combine with other agents. So I can't really predict the exact path forward for approval, but I think single agent approval is in the relatively near future.
How about, again, mantle cell and diffuse large? Let's just say mantle cell specifically. I mean,
absolutely. These should work in mantle cell just like they work in indolent lymphoma and CLL. And I think, you know, the excitement is exactly, you know, that in combining some of these agents with other similar agents or even with chemotherapy or rituximab. All good research questions.
Awesome. Again, anything else that's going on in terms of the biology, particularly of mantle cell genomics, predictors of whether you have to treat or not? Anything come out at ASH?
Yeah, I think nothing new. I mean, still Ki-67 is good. MIPI, the mantle cell IPI, sort of predicts for outcome. Doesn't really tell you whether you need to be treated per se. That's more of a clinical decision. There have been some really interesting data in a whole new area of mantle cell showing that epigenetics or DNA methylation may play a more important role in mantle cell than we appreciated. And so that opens the door for demethylating agents to be tested in mantle cell. It's not just MDS, but, you know, the lymphomas that may benefit from those agents.
Does that mean HDAC inhibitors, or are there other things that do that?
Well, so epigenetics could be HDAC inhibitors. They clearly have some preclinical data supporting the use of HDAC inhibitors in mantle cell. And even, you know, azacitidine and things like that. But the HDAC inhibitors are closer to use. There's been a lot of interesting biology by themselves and combining them with other agents, other, again, intracellular drugs. So the complexity of combining these drugs is really difficult and probably harder than just coming up with a combination to test in, you know, two drugs in a patient that makes some sort of sense because of non-overlapping toxicities.
Is R-EPOC pretty much standard of care for HIV lymphoma?
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people would use R-EPOC. There's some older data with infusional cyclophosphamide, doxorubicin, etoposide, or CDE, which is, when you think about it, is very similar. So I think my take on this is that infusional agents seem to work particularly well in the HIV-associated lymphomas, and EPOC is just one that we're all pretty familiar with. So I think I would say that's probably the standard, but I think you could do CDE as well, and that would be very similar.
Anything come out at ASH since we last met in terms of HIV lymphoma?
I really didn't see much on that. You know, the incidence clearly has gone down dramatically with better HIV control. And what's interesting is in the poorest prognosis for diffuse large B-cell HIV associated is based on your CD4 count being low. And now that many people are able to keep their CD4 counts higher, not only are they more responsive to treatment, they can tolerate treatment, but people, there's even relapse patients who are undergoing autologous stem cell transplant. It used to be there was no way you would transplant an HIV-positive patient, and now it's done successfully. So I think that's an area, not so much at ASH, but just in general, that's shown progress.